this uniform instills fear in many people, abject fear. So we have to be very cognizant of that. The uniform can speak for itself.
It just made me not like the police, because like they stopped me for no reason. And like every time I see them, I feel more scared than protected.
What made me want to come here? Like I'm still unsure. Like why am I here? But I just want to try to make a difference.
If you were to get pulled over for speeding, what would be your first thought when you saw the blue lights flash? Would it be, gee, I hope I get a warning instead of a ticket? Or would you be worried about whether or not you're going to make it home that night? Policing is an issue that divides Americans. Some people don't trust the police and fear that the officers who are sworn to protect and serve might actually harm them. Others think that police are under attack. But all of us have some sort of stake in this debate. After all, police are public servants. And so why, with all of this disagreement, would anyone want to become a police officer right now? This half hour, we're going to take a look at policing through the eyes of the people who are just entering the force and the people they'll be protecting. I spent about 6 months embedded with a class of recruits at the Madison Police Department. I wanted to get a firsthand look at why people become officers and how they're trained. I'm Bridget Bowden. This is New in Blue. It's a few minutes before 8 a.m. on the first day of the Madison Police Department Training Academy. 23 nervous recruits are sitting at desks dressed in suits and ties. They're greeted by Lieutenant Marianne Flynn Stotts, who helps run the academy.
As you know, you're coming into a profession that is under fire like it never has been at any other time. And here at Madison, we're incredibly proud of how we train.
She tells them that once they put on the uniform, they're going to be viewed differently.
This uniform instills fear in many people, abject fear. So we have to be very cognizant of that. The uniform can speak for itself. It can say, I'm somebody you should trust, or depending on somebody's background, it's, I'm somebody that you should fear. So be very mindful of what this does.
When I think of what a police officer looks like, the image that comes to mind is a tall, muscly guy, maybe with a mustache. Jessica Gillette is the exact opposite of that. She's a small woman, the mom of a six-year-old, and she has a master's degree in peace and conflict studies.
It's a trying and challenging time to get involved, but I think it's the most important time to get involved, especially for someone who's coming from a peace studies and conflict studies background as a peace practitioner, because that's really what we advocate in this department. And, you know, we're guardians of the community. We're not warriors. We're protectors.
She says the tension between police and communities of color was heavy on her mind before she applied for the job.
And so it really caused me to pause and reflect and say, is this something that I really want to do?
But Jessica says she wants to see a shift in the profession, and that motivated her to continue. And that's what I found with a lot of the recruits. Many of them want to be change agents. Take Ruben Gonzalez, one of the youngest recruits. He just graduated from the UW last year. His older brother is a cop in Chicago.
So they keep patrolled my neighborhood. And he would stop by and, like, eat lunch, and his partners would stop by and eat lunch at my house. And so, like, I grew up around them.
Unlike some of his classmates, Ruben never wanted to be a cop when he was growing up.
I would go outside and then, like, see just cops treat, like, my friends or the group that I was with unfairly, I guess you would say, just because of, like, the neighborhood that we grew up in and stuff like that. So had some negative experiences with police officers there.
But he changed his mind when he was in college studying social work. Ruben knows that police are under the microscope right now, but that's almost why he wants to be an officer.
There's no article that's going to be like, Ruben Gonzalez changes the view of like all Americans on police, and like that's not going to happen. But I feel like this department could change the view of the people of Madison.
But the people in Madison are divided. On the one hand, you've got citizens like David Glomp, who printed and distributed yard signs that say, "We support our Madison police."
And it's a bright yellow sign with white lettering and a police badge in the middle of it.
He says he wanted to show the police he cares.
To tell them that as much as they're being possibly maligned by individuals and groups, that we think they're doing a good job, and we would like to see them continue to be able to do that and do it better.
On the other hand, some people just don't trust the police, like the boys who meet every week in a community room in Madison's Allied Drive neighborhood.
But ain't nothing happened though.
Katie Ferens has lived in Allied for 14 years. When her son Keyshawn was 11 years old, she thought the boys in the neighborhood needed something positive to do. So she started a meeting group called Brotherhood.
Because one of my focuses of the group was to build better relationships with the police, because the boys had such negative, thoughts about the police. Just because of their life and, like, what they've experienced.
Now Keyshawn is 17, and he does not like cops. He tells me about a time a few years ago when he was waiting for the bus. Keyshawn says he was stopped and questioned about a stolen car he had nothing to do with. He says he was taken in and fingerprinted.
I mean, it just made me not like the police because, like, they stopped me for no reason. And, like, they did all that for nothing. Every time I see them, I feel more scared than protected.
The boys in the Brotherhood group are all high school age, and they're all Black. And they all share Keyshawn's perspective on police. They make this very clear.
Do you think that the police are fair to everyone?
No.
Oh, you shouldn't even wrote that question down.
No.
We could watch an episode of Cops and the show was right there that they don't treat people fairly.
But no matter how you look at it, one thing's for sure. The Madison Police Department has been heavily scrutinized, in part because of its use of force. This includes tactics like punching or kicking, using non-lethal weapons like a taser, and in the most extreme cases, firearms. A few cases of deadly force have sparked widespread criticism in the community. In 2012, Madison musician Paul Heenan attempted to enter a neighbor's house instead of his own. He was shot and killed by a Madison police officer. Amelia Royko Maurer was Heenan's housemate and friend. She was devastated.
You know, it's like when you lose a parent, you become one of those people that has one parent who can only other people with one parent can relate to. This sort of changes your life in that kind of way. You know, you know, if you've lived through something like this.
The shooting sparked concern about how officer-involved shootings are investigated. Amelia and a grassroots group she helped start lobbied successfully to change state law to require outside agencies to investigate deaths at the hands of police. So let's take a look at what Madison's new recruits actually learn about using force. In the academy, they're trained to use guns, pepper spray, tasers, and even their hands.
Then focus on the shooting.
On the first day of firearms class, the recruits line up in the training center's shooting range. They draw their new handguns out of their holsters and wait for the cue.
Shooters, be alert.
Then they fire. But they're not just learning how to shoot guns. They're learning how to make decisions. And training officer Chris Masterson says it can be really tough to teach split-second decision-making.
It's really hard, so they have to experience a lot of different things to kind of get there.
First, they start in the classroom. In one exercise, the recruits watch a few videos of police using force. Then they vote on whether they think the use of force was justified. Sometimes they all agree. Sometimes they're split 50-50. Sometimes it's one against the rest. Masterson says it's a good starting point for beginners.
It makes for a good conversation, I guess, for the class, because again, you start to hear people say, no, that's bad, no, that's good.
Lieutenant Tim Patton was the department's lead recruiter up until a few months ago. He says a lot of the new hires come in expecting to learn exactly when it's okay to use force and when it's not. But he says it's not that simple.
What we all want, I think what we wanted as new recruits who were learning this, is we wanted these bright line rules. If this happens, you do this, and if that happens, you do that, and it just doesn't work that way.
The legal standard for deadly force comes from a 1989 Supreme Court decision, Graham versus Connor. In 1984, in Charlotte, North Carolina, DeThorne Graham, who was diabetic, felt like he was having an insulin reaction. So he asked his friend to take him to the store to get some orange juice. When they got there, there was a long line, so they left. Officer Connor with the Charlotte Police Department was suspicious about him leaving so quickly. So he made an investigative stop. The officers handcuffed and injured Graham and did not treat his diabetes. Graham filed a federal lawsuit against the officers, and the case went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. It established that officers can use force when it's objectively reasonable from the perspective of the officer on the scene and not with the benefit of hindsight. Lieutenant Patton says that's really difficult to teach because it relies on the perception of each individual officer.
And what we see is that two human beings will look at the exact same situation, and one will say, yes, I believe I was in imminent danger, and another will say no. And so that is the challenges of training.
He says it's important that citizens understand how officers are trained.
And we have to have better conversations to be able to maybe move more quickly when we see something that the community finds unacceptable.
And when it comes to regular citizens, few are more educated about use of force than Amelia Royko Maurer. You heard from her a few minutes ago talking about what happened to her friend, Paul Heenan. Very early in the morning on November 9th, 2012, Amelia was woken up by her dog barking like crazy. She couldn't find Paul, and she could see blue and red lights flashing through the window.
And I see that there is a person laying, you know, near the sidewalk. Like, I can see it out my window. And, you know, the person's hair on the ground was kind of... like, Polly had curly hair, and the person's hair looked, you know, curly. But, you know, it didn't for a second occur to me that it could be him.
After a while, a detective came in the house and started asking a bunch of questions.
I just wanted to talk to the officer and be like, what's going on? Because in my mind, when I saw that badge, I was like, everything's going to be okay. They're going to help us. They're going to help Polly.
Slowly, she began to put the pieces together.
Then I hear Polly's parents' address or their names go across her radio. And it's at that point that I was like, okay, either that's him or he had something to do with that person being there.
And she realized that Paul had been killed by an officer.
I feel like with anything that's life-altering, I mean, you know, sort of cross the threshold of being and understanding. It really turned my world upside down.
The officer was cleared of any wrongdoing by the department and the Dane County District Attorney. He eventually agreed to retire. Amelia thought the system had failed her friend, and she wanted to take action. She's become one of the department's most vocal critics, but tries to focus on solutions. She says she thinks there's more to learn from Graham versus Connor than just the objective reasonableness standard.
My concern about Graham versus Connor is that there are other lessons there to learn from in that case. And for some reason, all the police department is focusing on is the one that says the only person that can really judge whether the officer was reasonable is the officer themselves.
She says when she reads the opinion, she sees a lesson about the value of life, and she hopes that the department sees this too.
I would hope that a police department that touts itself as one of the best in the nation might take a case law like that in the story and say, what else can we learn from this so we don't have to find ourselves in these circumstances?
There comes a point in the academy when the recruits are put on the receiving end of some types of force. They're all pepper sprayed in the face and shot with a taser. These are probably the most dreaded days of the whole academy. Pepper spray day was back in November, right before Thanksgiving. Here's recruit Ruben Gonzalez.
Honestly, I showed up and I was like, let's just get it over with. Like, let's do it. But yeah, once it happened, it sucked. Like, it was
hard to watch.
Yeah.
One by one, the recruits are taken outside and sprayed directly in the face.
Adam, Zebra, Ida. Keep going.
Then they have to open their eyes and do a series of tasks. They track someone with their gun, put handcuffs on a dummy, find their radio in a pile of stuff, and use it to call for help.
5702 Femme Right Drive, 1010.
Suspect in custody, OC deployed. I need backup and fire rescue.
Copy, Frank. Two's in a row.
Copy.
Good job.
Good job.
Only after all of that do they get to wash their eyes and faces.
Palms up, palms up. Good job, Sam. Palms up, palms up. Go, 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 go. Q-tip, Q-tip.
Just watching this was intense. I didn't even get sprayed, and I felt sick. By the end of the day, the air smelled like burnt toast, and everyone, even the spectators, were coughing. Pepper spray, which police call OC, is no joke. Ruben says after getting sprayed, he understands the consequences of the force he's now authorized to use.
It's intense, and it takes a while to recover. So I think for me, it was if OC is ever deployed, you know, being there to, you got it. Once you get the subject in cuffs or you have them detained, let's start the healing process because it sucks.
So how do police avoid these kinds of interactions? Coming up after this break, we'll explore how the recruits learn to better police the community by taking a look at themselves. You're listening to New in Blue. I'm Bridget Bowden. There's one improvement that police reform activists all over the country are calling for. They want police to be more aware of their implicit or unconscious bias. In the Madison Training Academy, the recruits are required to take a test that measures it. It works kind of like a video game and measures the speed at which you associate good or bad words with black or white faces. It takes about 10 minutes and, at the end, tells you your level of unconscious racism. Officer Jared Prado is part of a group within MPD that trains officers on implicit bias. He asks the recruits to stand up and think about their test results.
In a minute, I'm going to have you move within the room based on your result. On my end of the room, if your result was a strong preference for one group over another.
On the other end, people whose results said they had no preference and...
In between, we'll have moderate and then slight.
The recruits spread all the way across the room. Recruit Ray Gillard grew up in a poor, mostly African-American neighborhood on the south side of Chicago. He's black, and he says he was surprised that some of his classmates did have high levels of implicit bias against black people.
And then you just see how the room became divided when we took the test. It kind of opened your eyes that, well, they are still from a different area, so maybe they have the same biases.
He says he hopes knowing about their bias will help the recruits be fair when they hit the streets as officers.
So everybody's going to have their biases, but it's whether you act on those or not.
Next, Officer Prado shows a historical timeline of law enforcement and African Americans. The recruits learn about plantation police who kept slaves from running away. They're confronted with images from Bloody Sunday in Selma, Alabama, when civil rights marchers were brutally attacked by police. They see videos from recent killings of unarmed black men by police. Ray says it was hard to watch.
Because I didn't know that police in America first started as plantation police. So that really took me back to the doubt, like, did I really just join an organization that was originally started to discriminate against people of color.
Officer Prado says it's imperative that police learn their history and not gloss over the ugly parts.
Our history is something that we have to own. It's something that we can certainly do better today, but it's hard to do better when we don't contextualize these relationships that are institutional, historical in nature.
Ray says that history is hard to forget.
Because you still hear the also involved shooting with African Americans is still like, well, am I doing my part by joining a profession that have their biases and discriminate against people of my same situation that I come from?
So why did he want to become a police officer?
I'm still unsure. Like, why am I here? But I just want to try to make a difference so that people who's come from the same background in a predominantly poor neighborhood don't experience the same things that I had to go through.
At the very end of class, Officer Prado flashes a date on the projector. March 6th, 2015, the day Tony Robinson, an unarmed black teenager, was killed by a Madison officer. Neighbors had called police after seeing Robinson acting erratically in the street. The responding officer shot and killed Robinson after an altercation in a stairwell. The shooting caused days of protest.
Tony Robinson!
Who did they kill?
Tony Robinson!
The officer was cleared by an independent investigation and the DA. He's still employed with the MPD. What many people fear is that implicit bias is a contributing factor in cases like these. According to data analysis by the Washington Post, Black Americans are 2.5 times more likely than white Americans to be shot and killed by police officers. Some people think this is because officers are biased against Black people without even really knowing it. And in Madison, we've had 8 officer-involved shootings since 2012. One of the last blocks of training in the academy teaches the recruits what to expect after this happens. So-called officer-involved critical incidents can include shootings, in-custody deaths, and serious car crashes that involve squad cars. The training starts with a scenario. The recruits get a pretend call that there's an unwanted person in a building. They believe their partner has found the person and is okay. Here's training officer Chris Masterson.
As the door opens, they see our suspect swinging a shovel down at an officer on the ground, and there's fake blood on the ground. And the way it looks like the subject's striking our officer in the head.
Every recruit draws their gun and fires multiple rounds.
Some of them had genuine, like they felt guilty, like their partner was got hit because it took them too long to draw their gun out, or their decision-making directly affected their partner, which is good. It means they took the scenario real, but also shows like how emotional these things can be. Like, they know it's fake.
The next day, they're interviewed by a real MPD detective and an agent from the Department of Justice's Division of Criminal Investigation. Since 2014, state law has required all police-involved deaths to be investigated by an independent agency like DCI. This is separate from the use of force training, where they learn how to decide whether or not to pull the trigger. It's about what happens after that decision is already made. Lieutenant Marianne Flynn Stotz says the goal is to make sure the recruits know how to handle the emotional toll of a shooting.
It's likely the most isolating and life-impacting event that they're ever going to encounter. And as trainers, we have a responsibility to prepare them for that worst day of their life when they've had to make a deadly force decision.
But for activist Amelia Royko-Maurer, focusing the training on the officer side isn't enough.
And so if by law they're not required to think of the person who's laying on the ground and has a family and loved ones and who will now be in a sort of bottomless, falling, you know, state of pain, they just should then. They need to be taught to do that.
And she'd like to see more focus on mental wellness for officers, especially those who've been involved in a critical incident. For recruit Nick Cleary, going through this practice scenario helped ease his mind. Nick was an officer in a suburb of Madison before he joined the MPD this year, so he's been through training before. But he says this was the first time he's seen anything like this.
I mean, you hope you're never in that scenario or situation in real life, but having the scenario to fall back on, it's really nice because now I have an understanding of what happened. Before, it's this big giant mystery of, you know, say you're involved in an incident or a shooting or some kind of crash, you sit there and rack your brain as to, oh my gosh, what's happening next? How is this going to affect me?
A critical incident is not the only time an officer could be traumatized by their work. Cops see some really ugly stuff, so it's important that they figure out ways to take care of themselves mentally. For Nick, it's spending time with his family. For as long as his wife Kaylee has known him, he's been a cop. In fact, they actually met when he pulled her over for a broken license plate light.
I ended up pulling her over on Verona Road, thinking I either like have, you know, maybe a drunk person or somebody running drugs. And I walk up and there she is in sweatpants and glasses, and she tells me she was the DD for someone that night.
They played the dash cam footage of the stop at their wedding. But even though she's used to Nick's job, Kaylee says it's still hard, especially now that they have a 2-year-old daughter, Felina.
There's like a baseline level of worry that doesn't ever go away, even on off days, especially with her. And I think that's probably the biggest thing, is just the worry that something would happen to him. And I mean, I was reminded of it, you know, not too long ago when you were filling out paperwork and you asked me if something happened to you, who do you want to come to the door?
Yeah.
She says she wonders how Nick is able to process the less than cheery things he sometimes sees at work. According to the National Association of Chiefs of Police, cops are twice as likely to kill themselves than they are to be killed by a criminal.
But he comes home and he can just, like, shut off his cop brain, and he's just Nick. And it's always been, like, he'll come home and tell me stories about work, and I'll be like, how is that, like, how are you okay? Like, how can you, you know, how are you just, like, totally chill and come home and put your feet up on the table kind of thing? Like,
hi.
Hi, honey.
That's how.
Nick has been a cop for a while, but he says going through the training academy this time around gave him a renewed sense of purpose, and he was very excited to start field training.
I was really surprised my first day of night shift how excited I was to go to work and to actually be
doing stuff. He was like a kindergartner on the first day of school. He came home and was like, they do this and they don't do this and I got to do this.
Field training is like a residency for police officers. The recruits start out mostly observing their trainers. By the end of 3 months, these roles flip and the recruits become the primary officers. The class started out with 23 recruits. 21 made it through field training and were given their badges at a graduation ceremony in June. Nick, now Officer Cleary, was chosen by the class to give a speech.
Together, we have all chosen one of the most noble professions known to mankind, a place where we can and do, as individuals and a whole, make a difference. We've taken this challenge head-on in a time of widespread dissension, criticism, and fear. For that, we've all taken the road less traveled and will continue to do what is right in our hearts and our minds.
Understandably, criticism can have an especially sharp sting when you wear a bulletproof vest to work. Officers sacrifice a lot, and that gives them a huge sense of honor and pride about their work. For many, though, the road to trusting police is a long one. But the officers in this class say they want to make a difference, and they'll have their chance, one traffic stop, one arrest, one shift at a time. This project was edited by Noah Ovshinsky, archival audio from Gilman Halstead, sound design and mixing by Steve Gotcher. Special thanks to Abigail Becker. I'm Bridget Bowden. This has been New in Blue.